a concerto paid for by sales of soap, and a brand new work inspired by soul music, jazz funk, and James Brown. Those are the ingredients of the first half of this evening's prom, given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra and its principal guest conductor, David Robertson. And we're beginning with a bang, hammered out by Mark Antony Turnage, the world premiere performance in the year of his 50th birthday. And he was born 50 years after American romantic Samuel Barber, whose centenary we're marking in two proms this week, beginning this evening with his violin concerto from soloist Gil Shaham. In the second half, there's a work by one of the most original 20th century symphonists, Jean Sibelius, whose heroic and ultimately radiant Second Symphony was finished and first performed 8 years before Barber was even born. But let's find out more about the new piece, hammered out by British composer Mark Antony Turnage. He already has a pretty fine track record at the proms, from his Three Screaming Popes back in 1990 to Chicago Remains just a couple of years ago. But the sound world we're about to experience, he says, is quite different from some of the pieces people will have heard of his. Perhaps we're closer here in some ways to Turnage's Blood on the Floor, where he combined a big orchestra with jazz soloists, as the musical propulsion for Hammered Out does seem to come from other musical worlds.
I'm a big fan of quite a lot of 70s funk groups, particularly Tower of Power, who had an amazing group of saxes and brass and a singer and a rhythm section, which was probably the tightest playing you've ever heard by any band ever. So I very much loved that groove playing, and that's influenced this piece a lot. There are quite a few influences from R&B. I've been a big soul and R&B fan, particularly James Brown. I saw him perform live twice, and very much I want that sort of very brash and very tight, almost like a big band, but you know, usually this would be played by less players. So it's quite a challenge to write it for the whole orchestra. What's so fantastic is the BBC Symphony Orchestra play it really brilliantly and tightly, and that's essential. There are a couple of hidden things, but I'd quite like other people to find them out rather than me saying them.
Mark Antony Turnage, and the orchestral forces needed for Hammered Out are pretty substantial, including two soprano saxes, bass guitar, and a battery of percussion. Hammered Out, in case you hadn't guessed, refers to the percussion. Turnage describes it as like a drum kit, but instead it's spread out amongst five or six players alongside the constant hammering of the rest of the orchestra. And he says, if you know his earlier piece called Drowned Out, he reckons there are quite a few similarities, but it's not actually intended as a sequel to the earlier work. Well, that applause is for the leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra this evening, Stephen Bryant. And here comes the orchestra's California-born principal guest conductor, David Robertson, to introduce us to this brand new piece by Mark Antony Turnage, Hammered Out, in its world premiere performance here at the Royal Albert Hall. The energy of jazz, funk, soul and dance delivering us all the way to that exhilarating conclusion. You've just experienced the world premiere of Hammered Out by Mark Anthony Turnage, an orchestral toccata launched with all the power and energy of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by David Robertson, who's just welcomed the composer Mark Anthony Turnage on stage, embracing him warmly as he walks over, shakes leader Stephen Bryant's hand, applauds the orchestra for that performance before turning to face the promenaders and their cheers, bowing low before them. The work's opening, by the way, offers us something of a sneak preview. Mark Anthony says he's based it on a major climax from his new opera, Anna Nicole, which is based on the life and death of the celebrity and Playboy model Anna Nicole Smith. And that's due at the Royal Opera House next February. The final score was just delivered earlier this week, I'm told. Rehearsals begin in December. Back comes Mark Anthony Turnage onto the platform. He's already at work, he tells me, on a cello concerto for Paul Watkins, and there's also a ballet planned for Wayne McGregor at Sadler's Wells. David Robertson brings the BBC Symphony Orchestra to their feet before joining Mark Anthony Turnage, bowing to the audience here in the Royal Albert Hall. Well, after that bracing orchestral toccata, the lush romanticism of the next work in this evening's prom is going to come as quite a contrast. The violin concerto from 1939 by Samuel Barber, whose centenary we're marking at the proms this week. It's going to be performed by American violinist Gil Shaham, a graduate of Dorothy DeLay's famous violin class at the Juilliard School in New York, which Gil joined when he was just 11. But the Barber Concerto's story really begins at the other great American conservatoire, the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia, where Barber was a student. He graduated in 1934 alongside a young violinist called Iso Briselli, a pupil of another great teacher, Carl Flesch. And in case you were wondering, this is where the soap money I mentioned right at the start of the prom comes into the picture. Because Briselli was the adopted son of Samuel Fels, a wealthy industrialist who made his money manufacturing soap, and it was Fels who commissioned the concerto from Barber for his son to perform for the handsome fee of $1,000, half of it paid in advance. Well, what happened next is the subject of some dispute and open to interpretation, but it seems that Barber showed Briselli the first two movements, and you can believe either that he was completely happy with them, or that he complained that they weren't showy enough and that Barber promised him some real fireworks in the finale as compensation. And when the finale arrived a year later, well, choose between Briselli finding it unsatisfactory, as it didn't seem to bear any relation to the rest of the concerto, and that Barber refused to act on any of his suggestions for ways it could be expanded or developed, or that Briselli took one look at it, complained that it was too difficult, and his father asked for the money back. Well, either way, Briselli gave up the right to the first performance, and after Barber's concerto had been proved perfectly playable by a Curtis student, the official premiere was given by Albert Spaulding with the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Eugene Ormandy, on the 7th of February 1941. And it's never looked back. By the way, Barber and Briselli seem to have stayed friends, so that might affect which elements of the story you find most plausible. Well, the Barber's become one of the most frequently performed 20th century violin concertos, with its sweeping lyricism apparent right from the start, with the soloist launching us into the deliciously broad main theme without even a hint of an orchestral introduction. Barber sticks to the standard three-movement classical form. The romantic pulse of the work is supplied by perhaps surprisingly compact forces, double winds, a pair each of horns and trumpets, and just a touch of piano, if you keep your ears open, right at the start. And there's that controversial finale, a brilliant moto perpetuo, which may not have anything much to do with what comes before it, as young Briselli observed, but makes for a thrilling conclusion. And here to perform Samuel Barber's violin concerto is Illinois-born violinist Gil Shaham, with an instrument that's rather older than anything else in the programme, the Countess Polignac Stradivari from 1699.
Thank you. Thank you.
The whirlwind of an ending to the Violin Concerto from 1939 by Samuel Barber, which, despite its shaky start in life, has gone on to conquer the world. You've just heard it performed by American violinist Gil Shaham with the BBC Symphony Orchestra conducted by David Robertson, embracing each other with sheer delight at the end of that performance. And I love watching Gil Shaham play. He's the most self-effacing of virtuoso violinists. He always seems to be having such a fantastic time on the platform, grinning widely at members of the orchestra and just inviting you almost to join him in his physical enthusiasm for the music he's making. Wonderful to watch. Back he comes onto the platform. David Robertson, the conductor, talking with him, 19 to the dozen as they come back on. The whole orchestra applauding tonight's soloist. And we have a solo call there for the BBC Symphony Orchestra's oboist Richard Simpson for the solo at the start of the second movement, the slow movement. Just spare a thought for a moment for the student violinist at Philadelphia's Curtis Institute who really gave the work's first performance, a young man called Herbert Baumel. He was dragged into a practice room after getting to know it for just a couple of hours to prove that it was indeed playable. And he went on to play it with the Curtis Institute Orchestra, conducted by Fritz Reiner in their 1939-1940 concert season. But it's Albert Spaulding and Eugene Ormandy who get the official credit a year later. And the Barber was one of Gil Shaham's first major recordings back in the mid-1990s, a highly acclaimed account of that now classic coupling of Barber and Korngold concertos conducted by Andre Previn. But these days Gil has his own record label on which he's hoping to release highlights from his current project of violin concertos from the 1930s. Here he is again. And I think we're going to have a little more music. He's just talking to Stephen Bryant about it.
Gavotte in Rondo style. Bye bye.
Solo Bach here at the Proms, the Gavotte en Rondo from Bach's Partita No. 3 in E major for solo violin. Gil Shaham's encore tonight after his performance of the Barber Violin Concerto on the Countess Polignac Stradivari, named after a 19th century owner. Gil's had the use of it since the 1990s. And it's not on loan either. Gil calls it his retirement plan. Around the time I first met him, I asked him about his new instrument just after he'd first had it, and he gave it to me to hold. Antonio Stradivari, $16.99, he said proudly. To you, $15.99. David Robertson physically forcing Gil back onto the stage, refusing to come on himself so that he can take another solo round of applause and cheers here in the Albert Hall. It's not the last time we'll hear Gil Shaham at the Proms. He's standing in for an indisposed Lisa Batiashvili on Saturday, performing another great 20th century concerto written just before the Barber, Alban Berg's Concerto to the Memory of an Angel. That's the second of the Minnesota Orchestra's Proms with Osmo Vanska. The first is tomorrow when they begin with another piece marking Samuel Barber's centenary, Music for a Scene from Shelley. Both concerts beginning at 7:30 live here on BBC Radio 3. Well, the second half of this evening's Prom offers music from the dawn of the 20th century and one of its great symphonists, Jean Sibelius, whose second symphony, despite its pools of darkness, is ultimately one of his sunniest, and it has its origins not in his native Finland, but in music he first sketched on the Italian coast, although it really began to take shape in Finland in the summer of 1901. That's still to come, and in the interval, there's a wave of warm summer memory washing through this evening's 20 Minutes programme. The poet Nigel Ford is on hand to unearth from the BBC archives some reflections of this time of year from nearly three quarters of a century of broadcasting. Summer over England.
Do you remember Christmas? Blazing logs, snow, carols, the sky like a pincushion. And yet, if you look in your diaries, most of the time it was burst pipes, power cuts, and shops closing early. It's the same with summer. Hammocks and cushions, lupin seeds popping, sea and sky a perfect blue. Somehow the mind remembers anything that corresponds with the race memory, rather than the truth. But, of course, occasionally wonderful summers did happen. Here is Alastair Cook, 50 years ago, overwhelmed by the heat of the moment.
This special bulletin is called for to celebrate a very special news flash. The arrival in England, without even 4 minutes' warning, of a cloudless summer day. It will produce tears in Englishmen who are far from home and put them off their food and set them to sighing. For all Englishmen are victims of English poetry, which is especially rich in descriptions of beautiful summer days, perhaps because in life they are so few and far between.
Winter is cool-hearted. Spring is yea and nay. Autumn is a weathercock blown every way. Summer days for me, when every leaf is on the tree. That cunningly artless verse by Christina Rossetti summarises the character of the four seasons very well, but it comes down handsomely on the side of summer. Once the warm days begin, and we've had a good allowance of them this year, I think we all forget the charms of every other season.
Ah, Winford the wonderful Vaughan Thomas, as good at celebrating the changing face of Britain as he was of being the voice of royal rites and observances. Another poet, Longfellow, exclaims, "How beautiful is the rain after the dust and heat." Yeah, well, yes, it is, but in summer, it's not to everyone's taste.
At this moment, I know there's a heat haze hanging over the hills near me, making them almost float above the fields. And there'll be a cuckoo calling somewhere, lost in the woodlands along the River Nevern, where two well-informed local fishermen have been leaning permanently over the bridge for the last 2 weeks, praying for rain that's going to let the salmon up. And I looked at them and thought, how the countryside divides itself over this business of rain or no rain. The farmers need it. The townsfolk, they want none of it. And the waterworks engineers are on their knees for it. I was up in the wild country behind the vast complex of dams and reservoirs in the Ellen Valley up in Mid Wales. And the skylarks were springing up from the tufted grass as I walked, filling the clear air with their song. But I found the bogs that are so dangerous after heavy rain, they were now almost a springy pleasure to walk over. Splendid for me, but no good for the reservoirs.
That was the summer of 1982 from Radio 4's The Countryside in Midsummer. 45 years earlier, in 1937, the BBC broadcast a sequence of programmes, Summer Over the British Isles. Yes, we've pinched the title and a little of the first programme, Summer in London. Dated but dignified. This, for instance, is where summer hits London and surprises the residents.
This city now doth like a garment wear the beauty of the morning. London in the early morning, a thing very few Londoners see. The vast city lies before you like a sleeping giant. The streets, the squares, the river are deserted. You can see, as at no other time, the pattern of London. The main lines of the big streets, the snake-like winding of the Thames, and the green artery of trees and grass in parks and squares, which runs continuously through the wilderness of houses. The air is clear. The sun breaks through the morning mist and transforms it to a golden haze. Tangled masts and cranes and chimneys at this moment have an astonishing beauty. Now you can see the colour of London, the infinite shades that the smoke and the soot and the rain and the wind have worked into the grey fabric of London's stone, giving a strange magic to the towers and spires of the churches, while, floating on ethereal tides, St. Paul's above the city rides. and the early morning sounds of London. Perhaps you've heard them, half consciously, in the pause between sleep's ending and the day's beginning. The heavy lorry rattling your windows, the first train, the song of the birds, the milk cart, the slow crescendo of London coming to life on a summer morning.
Not so much traffic back in 1937. We shall be dipping into that again later. But if summer means dipping into the sea rather than dripping in the city, the man to paint that scene in all its gaudy colours is Dylan Thomas.
August bank holiday. A tune on an ice cream cornet. A slap of sea and a tickle of sand. A fanfare of sunshades opening. A wince and whinny of bathers dancing into deceptive water. A tuck of dresses, a rolling of trousers, a compromise of peddlers, a sunburn of girls and a lark of boys, a silent hullabaloo of balloons. I remember the sea telling lies in a shell held to my ear for a whole harmonious hollow minute by a small wet girl in an enormous bathing suit marked Corporation Property. I remember sharing the last of my moist buns with a boy and a lion, tawny and savage, with cruel nails and rapacious mouth, the little boy tore and devoured. Wild as seed cake, ferocious as a hearthrug, the depressed and verminous lion nibbled like a mouse at his half a bun and hiccuped in the sad dusk of his cage. Children all day capered or squealed by the glazed or bashing sea, and the steam organ wheezed its waltzes in the threadbare playground and the waste lot where the dodgems dodged behind the pickle factory. And mothers loudly warned their proud pink daughters or sons to put that jellyfish down, and fathers spread newspapers over their faces, and sand fleas hopped on the picnic lettuce, and someone had forgotten the salt. In those always radiant, rainless, lazily rowdy and sky-blue summers departed, I remember August Monday, from the rising of the sun over the stained and royal town to the husky hushing of the roundabout music and the dousing of the naphtha jets in the seaside fair, from bubble and squeak to the last of the sandy sandwiches.
Ah, how different from the life of your presenter in his hand-knitted, sagging, woolly trunks on Hailing Island. But in 1959, Woman's Hour revealed a few problems Dylan had not considered.
We had nothing but beautiful weather day after day, day after day. And this was one of the worst summers in the history of the umbrella manufacturers. And we really found things frantic as regards trying to sell umbrellas.
There was cricket on the sand and sand in the sponge cake, sand flies in the watercress and foolish, mulish, religious donkeys on the unwilling trot. Little naked navvies dug canals, children with spades and no ambition built fleeting castles. Wispy young men outside the bathing huts whistled at substantial young women and dogs who desired thrown stones more than the bones of elephants. Recalcitrant uncles huddled over Luke Ale in the tiger-striped marquees.
It's just the feeling you get when you see young people out in their nice summer dresses. You think, well, I'd like to look like they do. And you can't. You can't get dresses like nice summer dresses to fit big people. They don't look the same. Sleeveless don't look the same. And I always make one big promise when the nice weather comes. I'm going to start to slim, and I keep it up for a couple of weeks, and then think, oh, it's all gone. Can't keep it up any longer.
Mothers in black, like wobbling mountains, gasped under the discarded dresses of daughters who shrilly braved the gobbling waves. And fathers in the once-a-year sun took 50 winks. Oh, think of all the 50 winks along the paper-bagged sand.
Maybe Dylan Thomas could have found as much to wonder at in the centre of London during 1937. Hellfire from Speaker's Corner, a brass band barking, and the grumble of buses and coloured cats sneering from lacy windows.
At the third stroke, it will be 80 in the shade.
When the temperature reaches 70 degrees Fahrenheit, the beadle of the Bank of England is authorised to discard his caped overcoat of crimson and black. By that sign, it is said, city men know when it is summer and take off their waistcoats. On the face of it, the work of the city does not change much in summer. The bank messengers go about the streets, the traffic thunders, the sun beats down on the narrow, deep canyons that join the banks and the office blocks. But the city is a deceitful place, and every now and again there's a hint of summer in the behaviour of the men of affairs. They are apt to linger in front of sports shops, eyeing the bats and rackets, to break a journey at a shipping office to look at the cruising advertisements, to stop a little longer in Farringdon Street at the geranium stall. In fact, it's pretty certain, if you look and listen closely enough, you'll find the spirit of summer creeping through into the most unexpected places.
And back in 1961, it was the eye of Alastair Cook, wry and perceptive, that was carefully watching the unfortunate results of a perfect high summer.
A sharp observer would deduce that it was rare from the rash of tropical, not to say hilarious, costumes that burst on the streets. There were lots of shorts on grown men. Bounderish-looking men were out in blue linen trousers and play shirts. Hundreds of women were strapless, if not topless. At Lord's, the whole crowd looked from the stand in the shade like a great, brilliant bowl of confetti. Not one male in 100 wore a coat. And I played around for a while with the idea of shooting bits of 8mm movie and splicing them into movies taken of the crowds at the Yankee Stadium in New York. The faces and bodies of the men here were swarthier than Englishmen are supposed, by Americans, to be. But the audience for my home movies would notice the slanting vents of the men's pockets, the number of horn-rimmed glasses that had circular instead of oblong frames. They would notice the number of coatless men wearing braces, a social crime in any circumstances in America, almost equal to a woman's wearing white shoes in New York. Anyway, the only incident that moved a Briton to raise his voice was the moment when a man, blistering slowly in the sun, quietly took off his shirt. Now, you may have read that they have banned radio sets at Lord's. They most certainly banned the human chest. In a flash, a policeman appeared like a genie. He crushed the lout with a single word. He said, "Hello," and that fixed him. The man put his shirt back on and blushed under his lobster tan and slunk away.
Well, well, the Barmy Army has a longer history than I suspected. The late Laurie Lee, a poet like Dylan Thomas and a chronicler of cidery, summery childhood, here remembers a cricket match, slightly less disciplined, not in his native West Country, but Australia versus New Zealand at the Sydney Cricket Ground.
About a quarter of an hour before stumps, trouble began. The afternoon had been long and hot. The New Zealand side had done rather too well, and worse, supply of beers were running out. Every man was now squatting on a cairn of crumpled empties, his face sweating with thirst and emotion. And then suddenly they all got to their feet, picking up their cans and bottles, and began hurling them at one another.
"Don't like the look of this," said my brother to the Archbishop's son, and they put their heads down between their knees. Missiles were now whistling in all directions and tinkling and thumping onto the ground all round. Caught as we were in mid-fire, I felt in a favoured position, and I began to watch the battle with my head well up. Barrage and counter-barrage crisscrossed above me and seemed to go in waves as the men gathered fresh ammunition. Then looking down for a moment, I saw large drops of blood falling onto my white Somerset Maugham white tropical suiting. "That's rich-looking blood," I thought. Then I realised it was my own. I'd been clobbered on the head by a beer bottle. I felt no pain, but from this small flesh wound I bled like a slaughtered calf. No one around me seemed to have suffered any similar damage, so I lay back and made the most of it. My whites showed up the blood to some advantage, and I was soon surrounded by an admiring crowd. Now you've seen what he'd done. Ellie looks bad, don't he? Reckon he's dying. Better call a doctor. There was anxious sympathy all round, and maybe I overdid it, for suddenly I was being given the kiss of life by a policeman. I broke free from this and fell into the soft, cotton-clothed arms of some young student nurses from Adelaide who held my wound closed with their long, scented fingers till the more proper bandages arrived. Getting blooded on the hill at Sydney Cricket Ground has always struck me as something of a rare privilege for a foreigner. It was a badge of both the passion and remorse of the cricket-watching fraternity of Sydney, and it later made me many friends in the bars of that city.
Sydney is obviously no place for a Gloucestershire supporter. Laurie Lee, reading from his own Hill Cricket in 1982. But we don't need to go to the Antipodes to find the truth. I'd guess that a genuine echo of all our holidays by the sea is to be found, if only we'd admit it, in Les Dawson's views, confided to David Jacobs.
Well, it's very nice. We've got a lovely view of the Groyne and just past the sewage reclamation works and the disused minefield. And we're staying at Bideawee, which is a lovely little guest house. It's a 2 up and 2 down and the drains are blocked. And it's very nice. It's only 3 minutes from the sea upwards.
Have you got all the family with you?
Yes, I've got the mother-in-law camp with her. She's in Vietnam on a goodwill tour in Hanoi. But the wife's here and the children.
What sort of holiday are you having there with the family?
Oh, it's very nice. There's dancing on the jetty till 8 o'clock. That's once a month. And then there's a cafe open till 8:30 where you can get cider and a bun. And we are having some Morris dancers from Lithuania on the lake tomorrow.
Right. Would you have any recollections, perhaps, of your very first holiday as a child?
Yes, I remember it very well, actually. I was stolen by gypsies. My father drove the caravan. I had an idea something was wrong, because when I got back, he'd rented my room off.
Are you a swimmer?
Yes, actually, apropos swim, my wife lost 2 stone swimming last week.
Did she? Yes,
I couldn't understand it, because I tied them around her neck tight enough.
Seaside, of course, is not the only place to be in summer. Some people's tastes veer more inland, to parks and gardens, terraces, gazebos and ha-has. And if that's where you want to go, then you need a reliable guide. Someone such as Vita Sackville-West, who not only writes books, but gardens herself, digs, weeds, and gets her hands dirty.
Have you ever seen Chant Mall near Kirtistock? Apart from its lovely name, the house and garden taken together are ideally combined. The house dates from 1612, and although the garden owes most of its beauty to its present owners and to their extremely able gardener, the garden contrives to look as though it had been established there as long as the house itself. This was one of the places I really coveted. I should like to be the owner of Chant Mall. It seemed to me to include all the things that one likes best. A delicious house, built of grey stone. Wide views, terraced gardens, long walks through intelligently planted shrubberies. A semi-wild garden, where the natural streams were turned into winding ribbons of yellow and orange mimulus. Yes, Chant Mall was a place I coveted. It was so imaginative, so romantic. It wasn't too grand, it wasn't oppressive. It was a place in which one could have made one's home.
Yes. Victoria Sackville-West. Common as muck. Meanwhile, back in London, 1937, the summer night is gathering and the shadows are lengthening.
9 o'clock, and London a city of pleasure for those who've stayed in it. The city itself is deserted. The daytime workers are out on the road, on the courts, at home. But the West End is arrayed in bright, welcoming lights. And, of course, the proms in August. The floor of Queen's Hall packed, the fountain and the unchanging goldfish, and the most enthusiastic musical audience in the world.
Summer Over England was presented by Nigel Ford and produced by Simon Elms. And since those proms back in 1937 in the Queen's Hall, that famously enthusiastic musical audience is now to be found all around me here in the Royal Albert Hall. I'm Andrew McGregor. You join us all live here on BBC Radio 3 for the second part of this evening's prom given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra and its principal guest conductor, David Robertson. And they're going to perform a single symphony, the Second Symphony by Jean Sibelius. It was finished early in 1902, and Sibelius scored a major success with it, conducting the first performance himself in Helsinki. So let's get the conductor's view of the Second Symphony from David Robertson.
It's both a very dramatic work in the sense that we feel it is telling an internal story, and yet at the same time he is working to get his symphonies ever closer to a classical ideal, in which everything is related motivically in the way that Beethoven or Haydn or Mozart would have thought about it. But one of the things he's taken from this notion of a narrative story is that life is about transformation. And so we see in the Second Symphony that he may do something in the exposition according to classic sonata form, but when the recapitulation comes back, he refuses to do the thing in exactly the same way, and he's making lots of subtle changes. So we can see that he's actually really pushing his idea, his own unique personal viewpoint of what the symphony is, forward. So it's beyond the sort of rhapsodic nature of the first. It's not yet at the classicism of the third, but there are very definite indications of this notion of one single movement which encompasses everything, which he achieved with his final symphony, the seventh.
So that's the context for the Second Symphony, conductor David Robertson's view of how it fits into the canon. But what about the sound it makes?
The sound world is very much that of the Romantic orchestra, but not always with the choices that one would expect. So in certain moments, he will use instruments, for example, like the bassoon, to do things that are really rather heroic and that you wouldn't expect the bassoons to do, the beginning of the second movement. Other places in which the brass, instead of being there for their heaviness and their loud qualities, are actually there to give a sort of sense of space with these very soft chords that, unless you're really paying attention, you won't even find audible. And yet if they weren't there, suddenly the music would sound somehow less expansive. These are devices that he's more or less inventing with this symphony. And this is very radical. This is the sort of thing that's going on with the sound world. He's exploring this almost inner sound of the orchestra rather than just the question of how best to make the melody sound luscious.
And luscious it certainly can sound with its broad melodies and rich orchestration, and for all its typically Sibelian shadows. The second is ultimately one of his most radiant symphonies. Well, we just heard the voice of David Robertson, the principal guest conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and here he comes to conduct the Symphony No. 2 in D major by Jean Sibelius.
Thank you.
A work hailed after its first performance in Helsinki in 1902 as a definitive masterpiece. One of the few symphonic creations of our time that points in the same direction as Beethoven's symphonies. The Symphony No. 2 in D major, opus 43, by the Finnish composer Jean Sibelius, performed here at this evening's BBC Prom in the Royal Albert Hall by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, led by Stephen Bryant, and conducted by its Californian principal guest conductor, David Robertson, who's just come back onto the stage, staying at the back of the platform, making sure that the timpanist and the full complement of brass players on the back row get their much-deserved ovation from the promenaders. Now it's the turn of the winds of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And finally, the full complement of strings rises to share in the acclaim as well. But it's not the last Sibelius at this season's proms. His evergreen Corellia Suite is on the programme a week tomorrow, Sunday the 5th, which is Henry Wood Day at the proms, an all-day celebration of the proms' founder and conductor, recreating The Last Night from a century ago, 1910. And then the evening concert of music premiered by or closely associated with Henry Wood, played by the Ulster Orchestra, and including that Corellia Suite by Sibelius. Back comes David Robertson. And this orchestra's work at the proms is far from over. They're back a week on Wednesday with chief conductor Jerzy Bielochlawek. And, of course, there's one final premiere ahead of it this season. Jonathan Dove's A Song of Joys, which opens the last night of the proms on Saturday the 11th, all live here on BBC Radio 3. And they're off to the Edinburgh Festival as well. Well, tomorrow sees another great Bruckner symphony, number 4, The Romantic, from the Minnesota Orchestra and Finnish music director and celebrated Sibelian Osmo Vanska. So this time, the Finnish conductor gets Barber. He's conducting Barber in tomorrow night's prom. It's the American who gets Sibelius. And here at the Royal Albert Hall, we're all hammered out, thanks to Mark Antony Turnage's world premiere earlier, to keep us buzzing while we wait for Jamie Cullum to take to this famous stage in the late prom. Back in Broadcasting House, here's Ian Skelly.
Andrew, thank you very much indeed. Andrew McGregor at the Royal Albert Hall for the first of our two live proms tonight. As he says, we're back there for something a little different at 10:15. Don't forget that you can hear tonight's first prom, again, if you missed some of it, on Wednesday the 8th of September. That's in the afternoon on Radio 3 from 2 o'clock. Tomorrow, by the way, it's the prom from last Thursday, which was given by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra under Martin Brabbins. They gave the first UK performance of a new piece by James Dillon. That was alongside music by Mozart, Rimsky-Korsakov, and to end, Tchaikovsky, his second symphony. That's all from 2:20 tomorrow afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. And there are plenty of proms-related features when you wake up to the world via Radio 3.
On Breakfast, each morning through the summer prom season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties, in Breakfast on Radio 3, every morning from 7.
And you can learn a great deal about the proms on the Radio 3 website as well, bbc.co.uk/radio3. Via that, you can go to the BBC iPlayer and hear tonight's proms anytime you'd like to. And it's also where you can offer your own review of tonight's performance by clicking on the button marked Share at the BBC Proms website. So it's worth taking a look at both of those sites. A wealth of fascinating material. You could say it's what the internet was invented for. Well, as Andrew was saying, we return to the Royal Albert Hall for that late-night prom with Jamie Cullum. Before then, we're going to turn our attention to another popular hall in times gone by, the Victorian Music Hall. Billy Bragg investigates what it was really like to work in them, and for that matter, to be a member of the audience. He even gives a performance himself in one of them in the Hoxton Hall. The Good Old Days, presented by Billy Bragg, is at 9:15 tonight on Radio 3. And to take us there, the music of Maurice Ravel, a piano transcription of his Memorial to a Lost World. He composed La Valse in the wake of the First World War, and he used the waltz as his means of describing a shattered culture that lay in ruins in the aftermath of the conflict. The waltz builds to a confidence, but slowly the decadence sets in. The dance becomes ever more desperate, ever more destructive. This is the piano transcription for two pianos, and the two pianists here are Sergio Tiempo and Karin Lechner, that make up the duo Lechner-Tiempo. the duo Lechner Tiempo playing the transcription for two pianos of Ravel's La Valse. Well, in an hour from now on Radio 3, we're going to be crossing live once again to the Royal Albert Hall for a late-night prom given by Jamie Cullen and the Heritage Orchestra teaming up together to provide music that fuses rock and electronica and no doubt a great deal of Jamie's own style of jazz. Well, to get us in the mood for that at 10:15, here's a bit of jazz fusion from an earlier generation created by the magic of Yehudi Menuhin and Stefan Grappelli. Unique combination, Yehudi Menuhin and Stefan Grappelli playing Crazy Rhythm from T for Two. And don't forget, Jamie Cullen is live here on BBC Radio 3 in just under an hour from now, live from the Royal Albert Hall in a late night prom. But now on Radio 3, Billy Bragg explores the world of Victorian Music Hall, where he reveals that it was in fact Britain's first pop music, an urban folk culture in which raucous song vied with cutthroat commercialism. It's easy to feel nostalgic about Music Hall, but was it really the good old days?
Started an ordinary and I thought I'd die. When pointing to me, watch a chain, he hollered to me, hey!
You look dapper from your nappy to your feet, dressed in style with a brand new dial. Father's old green Zion. I wouldn't give you dubbers for your old white shack. Oh, Zion, oh, Zion.
Like many people, I learnt the old musical songs from my family, standing around the piano at Christmas, all singing along as my nan bashed out the tunes on an old upright. As far as I'm concerned, these are Britain's urban folk songs. Lowbrow or highbrow, whether you like it or not, you'll probably know the chorus.
In the old iron, in the
All the songs, all, nearly all of them, seem so familiar.
My nan used to sing The Boy I Love Is Up in the Gallery, and, you know, My Old Man's So Follow the Van. It's a shame that a lot of people don't know that it was Myra Lloyd that sung these songs. When you sing them, you say, oh, I didn't know that Myra Lloyd sung those.
Paid a shilling to go up into the gods, and we were laughing before he came on because we knew what he was going to sing, and it was the same old thing, but it was so funny. But we're talking about 80 years ago when I first went to the music hall, and it's difficult to say who was top of the bill, who was bottom of the bill. Harry Champion, he used to sing Any Old Iron.
My father, who was born in 1915 and grew up in Stepney, he sang round the house all the time, and he sang the musical songs, the well-known ones. I mean, I just grew up knowing them all so well.
Even today at football grounds, there are chants to the tunes of things like I Do Like to Be Beside the Seaside. They have retained their kind of patina, as a kind of sediment in the mind, and the tunes bubble up.
Numinous in evanescence, non pareil nenuphar of nubility.
But the way we look at musical has been obscured by nostalgia. It's been cleaned up and sugar-coated. It's become like steam trains or trams, the preserve of backward-looking enthusiasts. I want to reclaim Music Hall from its Victorian dust and find out what it was really about. I'm in Abney Park Cemetery in North London, which is a big old Victorian necropolis that was founded for the burial of non-conformists. And as soon as you walk in the back gates there, it's the grave of William Booth, the founder and first general of the Salvation Army. But we're here to find the grave of a different kind of nonconformist down this gravelly path. Abney Park Cemetery is the resting place of a number of music hall greats.
At last, another living being. Hi, Neil, I'm Billy Craig.
Neil Morcunis of the Music Hall Guild of Britain and America is showing me their graves.
So do you scour graveyards for these people?
We do indeed.
Into the undergrowth, then.
That's right. Watch your step. Mm-hmm. So we're going to see the grave of your original Champagne Charlie.
Right. George Leybourne, who died September 15th, 1884, aged 42 years.
Champagne Charlie is my name.
George Leybourne was part of the early group of musical performers who were stars in the 1860s and 1870s. I'll drink every drop there is. He made a huge name for himself and probably lived too much of the Champagne Charlie lifestyle, dying at 42.
Well, if you a lot of champagne, a lot of Charlie, we'll do that too.
Champagne Charlie is my name.
Leybourne originally came from Newcastle and first appeared at the Whitechapel Music Hall in 1864. He was the pioneer of a new type of comic character, who would embody the hedonistic and irreverent spirit of music hall. In pictures and cartoon sketches, he often wears a top hat and tails and waves a bottle of vintage Moët and Chandon champagne around. But at the heart of his performance was a Mickey take on the Toffs. His fellow singer Vance responded with a song called Clico, and their rivalry was a big hit with the public.
Most of the popular music hall artists adopted a persona, which was represented by costume and by stance and by gesture.
Geoffrey Richards is Professor of Cultural History at Lancaster University.
One of the most popular characters was the Lion Comique, of whom the great exponent was George Leybourne, Champagne Charlie. This was a caricature dandy or swell, partly aping the upper classes, but also celebrating hedonism. The whole duel they had, this musical duel they had, songs about drink. After Champagne Charlie came out, Vance had one on Burgundy, and then Charlie had one on something else, and so on and so forth. And they were battle backwards and forwards songs about drink. And that was a character which was partly a send-up, but partly an affirmation of a kind of hedonistic lifestyle.
Resting with George is his son-in-law, the great Albert Chevalier. They actually share a grave. Chevalier was born in London's Notting Hill and epitomised the way music hall would become respectable and middle class by the end of the 19th century.
What's very interesting about Albert Chevalier is that he came from a legitimate theatre background.
I got a pen,
He was known as the Costa's Laureate. He would do lots of Costa monologues, and probably his most famous song is My Old Dutch.
And Acosta being a costermonger.
That's right.
Someone who sold fruit and veg
that's
that
right.
they grew themselves on the street.
That's correct.
I'm also hoping to meet Fenton Gray, whose ancestor, who trod the boards, is buried in here. Fenton, there you are, mate.
Hello, Billy. Very nice to meet you.
Good to meet you.
Well, here I am at the grave of my great-grandfather, Dan Crawley, who's just there, that beautiful-looking angel.
What was his act? What was the centre of his act?
Well, he was a sort of eccentric comedian, always songs. Obviously, he must have done patter as well. And he gradually incorporated drag into his music hall act. And his wife, Lillian, was a male impersonator, so she wore the trousers and he wore the dress.
That must have been, that must have been interesting at the, home, at the dinner table, of an evening.
He was likened to Dan Leno, and at the beginning of his career, he used to impersonate Dan Leno.
Like Dan Leno, Fenton Gray is one of Britain's leading character actors and comic singers.
Now, I'm not what people call a flirt.
So I understand that you started incorporating some of your great-grandfather's songs into your act today.
Yeah, quite often I do cabaret performances, and it seemed like a good opportunity to try a couple of his numbers out and just see how they went down.
As part of this programme, I'm going to get the opportunity to come and sing some songs with you at one of your gigs.
Absolutely, I'm looking forward to it. We're we're doing a gig at Hoxton Hall, also steeped in history.
The prospect of performing at Hoxton Hall is giving me a few nerves.
It's my loud piano.
No, it does play with my nan, actually. My nan used to bang it. It's pretty good. I like it. I gave her help.
Although I grew up with these songs, I've never actually performed them in public while sober before. So a bit of rehearsal is in order with pianist Charles Miller.
With a 2 hour and a chat. I wonder what that is. Cause it's little things like that one does you good.
Classic histories of the genre, like Harold Scott's The Early Doors, claimed that music hall was invented by one or two impresarios in London. In fact, it grew organically out of working-class pub culture. The first histories of music hall were written by middle-class journalists or literary types.
The authors of the early music hall books were journalists.
Dagmar Kift is a curator at the Westphalian Industrial Museum in Dortmund, Germany.
They aspired to work in London, visited the London music halls, and described the glamour and the good old times they had in those halls. They certainly weren't interested in going into dull working-class cities of the north and looking into the cultural scene there.
A dazzling blaze of gas, the sharp clink of pewter pots and glasses, an incessant babble of voices, male and female, talking, shouting and laughing, an insignificant-looking creature standing in the centre of a large stage and lustily stretching his lungs in the somewhat vain endeavour to make himself audible above the general clamour. Such is the appearance presented by the interior of a music hall.
Reports like this from the Dublin University Gazette tend to put a rosy glow on music hall. Frustrated by the anecdotal nature of the existing literature, Dagmar Kift turned to local newspaper reports in Britain to put music hall into its social context.
So I wondered whether reports of fires or other catastrophes might not shed some light. The lists of the casualties indicate that the audiences in the music halls in the northern industrial cities were working class, lower middle class, male and female, and to a high percentage young people from the age of 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 were people who were already working in factories, who had finished school, and they claimed the same right to have being entertained as everybody else.
It's not so different from today, really. The urban young letting off steam. Music hall attracted the kind of audience who today would be going clubbing.
Grace's Alley, yeah.
But to get a real picture of what these early music halls felt like, I set out to look round one of these places. They're surprisingly hard to find.
I'm standing in an alley just off of Cable Street in East London, Grace's Alley, and as you can hear, just over the wall is a school. The kids are out in the playground. And in front of me is the facade of Wilton's Music Hall, one of the original music halls and the last of its kind still preserved here in the East End. And I'm with Jackie Bratton and John Earle. So let's go inside and have a look at this wonderful building.
Well, here we are in a narrow hallway. This gives you no idea of what you're going to see. You see this mysterious staircase going up in front of you, apparently leading nowhere, and dark passages on either side.
So we're following through this passageway, John, into this beautiful, beautiful hall.
And as you can see, it's hugely bigger than the pub it stands behind.
It's massive. Any old iron? Oh, the acoustics are just great, aren't they? That is really incredible.
The interesting thing about the high roof is that there's been recently an acoustic test on it, which shows that the acoustics, if the stage is in use, are virtually the same as the Wigmore Hall.
Any old iron, any old iron.
The first halls grew very organically out of the rooms of the pub, so the bar let you through into a singing room, and as those singing rooms were pulled down and built ever bigger and bigger, they were built on the pattern of the public hall of the time, an oblong, shoebox-shaped room.
Jackie Bratton is Professor of Theatre and Cultural History at the University of London.
On the floor of the hall, there would be tables in the front third or so, with groups gathered round them, and behind that there would be rows of benches with backs, and on the backs of the benches there would be a ledge for the people behind to park their drinks on. And all round the sides there was lots of circulation room.
Wilton's was part of an extraordinary boom in music hall building in the 1860s. Hundreds of many different sizes were built around London. There was the Canterbury in Lambeth, for example, the Oxford on Oxford Street, and Collins Music Hall in Islington. But very few of these buildings survive in their original form.
In the whole country, we only have really two other substantial survivors of the period. One is in Glasgow, the Britannia. One is in Leeds, the City Varieties. The rarity of physical remains from that period can't be overemphasised. Music halls, even partly altered music halls of that period, are now much rarer than Saxon churches.
The expansion of pubs into music halls was a consequence of the Industrial Revolution. And at the heart of that revolution was London, the trading hub of the empire.
I keep the pub, the Rose and Crown, I should say, it keeps me.
In the first half of the 19th century, there was a huge influx of people into the capital.
Hundreds of thousands of people are suddenly arriving and they need something to do, somewhere to go. You get amateur singing to start with, you get free and easy nights, club nights. And then by the 40s, this has become obviously a nice little earner. And the publicans think, I can get bigger and bigger audiences in here because there are more and more people around. And they start to employ professionals. They get a chairman, they get a pianist, and the once or twice a week club night turns into every night entertainment.
On we blow, then the botman cries, the blooming pub's on fire. On fire, says Brown.
With only one exit through the pub at the front, Wilton's would have been a virtual death trap in the event of a fire, of which there were many in the old music halls. This prompted an Act of Parliament, passed in 1878, that required the halls to be made safe. Health and safety ultimately did for places like this, but there were other people, weren't there, who were concerned with the moral health and safety of the audience.
This was thought of as the sort of outreach arm of the drinks industry, really. People were lured in here, was the fear, and various kinds of immorality, starting with drink but going to other places, would take place. And this probably wasn't the case, and you also found apologists saying, on the contrary, the music hall is a force for the good because the working man brings his wife with him when he comes to these places. He will get less drunk. The whole thing is a social activity that is a good idea.
But it wasn't just the drink. What really disturbed the upper classes was the double life that the music hall created. The boundaries of what was respectable in Victorian Britain were slowly being broken down. Geoffrey Richards.
The atmosphere was extremely relaxed and free and easy. The traditional audience was very distinctive. Young, wage-earning adults, both working class and lower middle class. Men and women, people who went for a good night out, which is why it tended to be in its early days, more raucous, more anti-authoritarian. That is the kind of attitude, the irreverent attitude of young people under 25. There were middle-class people in the audience too, but they were also tended to be young wage earners. They were clerks and they were shop assistants, the people who were in the new retail industries, who may have emerged from the working class but were becoming middle class.
As was the case with George Leybourne, now resting in Abney Park Cemetery, the musical songs were performed theatrically. The singers parodied the characters that they saw around them on the streets.
In the early days, when people first began to dress and sing in character, it was partially out of a fascination with the new urban landscape around them, that there were people who were costermongers, there were people who were chimney sweeps, there were the gas man. All kinds of new types had suddenly appeared in the urban landscape, and it was almost a way of situating the audience within this much more varied array of human activity than had been available to you in previous generations.
But while the characters reflected life on the streets, the subject matter of the songs reflected life on the inside. Everyday domestic concerns and matters of the heart and other regions of the body.
Music hall songs tended to be about love, which was treated romantically and sentimentally. So you had songs like The Boy I Love Is Up in the Gallery and I'll Be Your Sweetheart. Marriage, which tended to be regarded as a trap, and henpecking wife was a theme of songs. A very famous one is Gus Elan's It's a Great Big Shame. It's a great big shame, and if she belonged to me,
I'd let her know who killed. And nagging at a fella what is 6 foot 3, and her only 5 foot 2. Hadn't been married not a month nor more, when underneath her thumb goes Jim. How isn't it a pity as the likes of her should pat upon the likes of him?
And then there's the subject of sex, which was treated always with innuendo. The great exponent of this was Mary Lloyd, and her songs are full of suggestive lines, which the audience knew what they were about, even if they were ostensibly about something else. So, for instance, she would come on with a parasol and sing, I haven't had it up for a week. Or she would sing about a woman travelling on the train, she's never had her ticket punched before. And then one of her favourite songs, A Little of What You Fancy Does You Good, one line is, suppose it makes you fat, I don't worry over that. Well, the fatness is becoming pregnant.
Now I always, always having it, if you fancy it. If you fancy it, that's understood. And suppose it makes you fat, I don't worry over that. For the little of what you fancy does you good.
Because of her reputation for innuendo, she was banned from the first ever Royal Variety performance in 1912. This was when the musicals were becoming respectable. She never became respectable. She remained always a kind of raucous, earthy voice of the people.
Since Mother Eve in the garden long ago started a fashion, fashion's been a passion. Eve wore a costume we might describe as brief.
Actress Jessie Wallace brought Mary Lloyd to life brilliantly in a recent BBC television drama based on the singer's life. Mary Lloyd's trademark gesture was the knowing wink. It was key to the richly ironic sauciness that Jessie brought to the screen.
I had to get the movements right, you know, the little wink of the eye and the movement of her bum and all that sort of tongue-in-cheek stuff.
The girls in the prehistoric days.
She wore mini skirts and low-cut tops. For Victorian times, that was really risky.
Wearing just a row of beads and not much more. Fancy me.
She was very outspoken. She always said what she thought. She always sort of stuck her two fingers up to the system. But that's what was great about her.
When I take my morning promenade, quite a fashion card on the promenade. Now I don't mind nice boys staring hard if it satisfies their desire.
When I did the, and I don't mind nice boys staring hard, when I got to that bit, I had a parasol and I lifted it up in a rude gesture, but they'd done a close shot of that, so they didn't get that in because I think I went a bit too far there.
This is Vesta Tilly singing Jolly Good Luck to the Girl Who Loves a Soldier, which she sang impersonating a young man.
Jolly
The musical singers treated conventional categories of gender and class with a subversive irony. It's sometimes hard for us today to work out exactly what was going on, especially when they started cross-dressing.
There were male and female impersonators, and this is very interesting because you had women like Vesta Tilley and later Hetty King playing soldiers and playing dandies and almost parodying them. And then you had male performers like Dan Leno, for instance, who would dress up as a kind of harridan, as a fearsome landlady or stepmother figure.
I'm a young girl of 18. I used to be Mother Goose. And now I am what I was before I was what I am now.
And I did promise at my last gig that I would put a dress on, and I'm going to put a dress on tonight. Yay! Yay! First time in my life, I hesitate. At least in public.
But this had the effect of actually endorsing gender images, because by slightly sending them up and then going back to normal afterwards, you actually endorse the roles that people apparently have in society.
Ever since there have been actresses on the stage, there have been actresses cross-dressing as boys, because there is a perennial attraction in being able to see a woman's legs on the stage. But I think that the act of male impersonation on the music halls is something slightly different to that.
There's a good time coming for the ladies, a good time coming by and by.
Vesta Tilley prided herself on the perfection of her imitation of masculinity. With every singer, it wasn't equally loving. There are stories about male impersonators singing very scornful anti-male songs. How did you get those trousers on, and did they hurt you much? And the young swells in the first rows of the audience getting very incensed about this picture of themselves. But what that singer, it's Nellie Power in this instance, is doing is singing over their heads to the working class men behind, who didn't wear that kind of clothes and who thought that these visitors from the West End were pretty effete and despicable. So Nellie Power is projecting two different messages to different parts of the house. And she's said to have had to dodge soda siphons thrown from the stalls when she got particularly outrageous.
There's a wonderful painting in the Museum of London called Popularity, which depicts hundreds of musical stars.
But the great thing about this picture is almost everybody who's in the picture is defined by the hat they're wearing.
Yeah,
you know, there's obviously some Victorian men here who are still wearing sort of bowlers and Victorian and top hats there. Then they're the kind of proto-Edwardians wearing the straw boaters. Mm. But most interesting of all, there's this small corner where there's just a couple of white actors in black face. Now, clearly, the minstrelsy did play a role in music hall.
Yeah.
What was the context of bringing white men in blackface into this? Because we're in a situation where almost everyone was in some kind of transgressive costume. Working class people were dressed as toffs. Middle class people like Albert Chevalier were dressed as costers. Men were dressed as women. Women were dressed as men. And into this mix, you throw people in blackface. What was the context of their appearance?
A great many people start in blackface. And I think if you go on with what you think is going to be an act and you fail, they aren't going to know you next time.
Jackie Bratton.
If you were in blackface, you change your name, wash it off, you become an Irish comedian, and you're somebody new, you can try again. Also, it's got all kinds of resonances that strike deep into what you might call English folk culture.
Mm.
Blacking your face in order to go out and break the looms.
Yep.
Blacking your face in order to perform a dance in the streets as some sort of clog dancer or Morris man.
She ain't no pickaninny from way down the West Virginia, but she sets the dream and wears the salmon water flow.
So the blackface in some ways was more of a license to do something a bit different.
Yes.
Rather than a racial...
Yeah. It was licensed for a kind of grotesque clowning. And you, on many, many, many music hall bills, you find a pair of funny blacks.
Yeah.
That's what it says on the billing, funny blacks.
You can get a feel for the theatricality and style of these performers from contemporary paintings. But as a singer-songwriter myself, I want to find out how these character songs are put together and what actually makes music hall songs distinctive. And where better than in the venue where I'm going to be performing music hall songs myself?
I'm in Hoxton Hall in East London, which is a surviving example of the early music hall built in the 1860s. And I'm meeting with Derek Scott, who's Professor of Music at Leeds University. Derek, you're leaning up against a fabulous old upright piano there. Perhaps you could sit at it and talk a little bit about some of the character songs that were in the music hall.
We're in a hall built in the 1860s. There are about 25,000 Jews living in the East End at this sort of time. There will be a Jewish influence on music hall song. Here's an example of a Jewish song. Oi, oi, what a game it is, oi, oi. You'd add something to the accompaniment that suggested something a little bit culturally different. So this song, the verse pattern is... So a little bit of klezmer there, you see.
Yeah, a bit klezmer. So what was the response of the highbrow musical establishment to the arrival of music hall in the Victorian period?
Well, they hated the musical style as much as they hated the words, really, and as much as they hated some of the accents in which it was sung. The composer, Hubert Parry, thought that the musical style was as horrible as the sound of Cockney speech itself. If I give a couple of examples from If It Wasn't for the Houses in Between, the Gus Eland song, the opening of it begins with this figure. Parry would have hated that, because what should happen in classical practice is this. This note, it doesn't really fit the chord. It sounds fine, but it breaks the classical rules. In the 18th century, Mozart could be popular. It was still serious music because the style was just the same. What happens with the music hall is you have a style that is not the same style as classical music. The music hall establishes the verse plus chorus song. Usually you'll have